So outside of retail itself, it's a very good model because it's sitting within this retail category where a lot of people are very hesitant to invest in it, much less look at it. They don't really know how to look at it because you're dealing with leases that are very different than multifamily and residential as a whole.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm so excited to introduce our guest for the day, all the way from Japan, Anthony Pinto. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Suja. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me join you here.
Absolutely. Well, really excited to dive into your story and talk about, you know, things that you've learned along the way. So why don't you start us off by giving us a bit of background as to, you know, how and why you got into the real estate space?
Sure. So I'm Anthony Pinto. I'm active duty submarine officer currently stationed in Japan. Been here for about a year and a half and have another year and a half to go. Got into real estate mainly because I didn't want to make it the Navy a career. And I knew that pretty early on that I didn't want to make it a career. So I was, you know, I was looking for other aspects or I guess money-making opportunities, both while I was in, but also, you know, once I got out. And, you know, this idea of real estate investing really spoke to me as a way to take more control over my finances. I guess my ability to build my future in a more realistic manner than, in my opinion, than betting on like the capital market and in dealing with stocks and crypto and all that. So, you know, I got into real estate back in 2018, back when I was still on my sea tour and the Norfolk area. And ever since then, I've kind of dabbled in, you know, small multifamily, single family homes, Airbnbs, large apartment complexes, shopping centers, note lending, kind of a lot of different pies I've had my fingers in since then. So.
And have you done that all long distance?
No. So for the first like year or so, we were back in the States in the Norfolk area. And then I did some small multifamily and some single family homes when I was back there in an Airbnb. We actually bought a 4-unit in the Portsmouth area of Hampton Roads and lived in one of the units and rented out the other 3. And then did one of the units as an Airbnb. And that was pretty profitable when we were actually living there. I mean, we were essentially living for free. So house hacking that property.
Yeah.
Which is really nice. You know, it gave us a good first foray into real estate investing, living there. Like I did most of the renovations and work myself and, you know, furnished it all ourselves and all of that and managed the Airbnb ourselves. But then we ended up moving out here at the end of 2019 and we've been here ever since then. So I would say it's half and half. So the majority of the larger deals we've done, like the large apartment complexes have been since I've been here in the shopping centers. But our start was really back in the States.
Yeah.
With that first squad.
Definitely. Well, there's a lot there on your intro. Thanks so much. And I just want to touch on one piece, which is why it was, in your opinion, that real estate spoke to you as opposed to other ways that you could have kind of gotten more control over your finances.
Sure. So good question. I would say real estate offers an opportunity to more directly control the asset itself. And it really is a real asset. It's not something that's a piece of paper or something that's ultimately, you know, like take example for Tesla stock, done amazing over the past like couple of years. But, you know, it's one word from a CEO and the whole stock can, you know, can tumble. And the same is true for really any other companies or any other stocks that are out there. And you know, and this is coming from someone who's dealt with kind of both sides of it. You know, I've lost money, made money in stock and bonds and mutual funds and all that. But the control aspect was really what was big for me is, especially with commercial real estate, is, you know, I can directly affect the value of a property based off of the amount of effort or work or money that I put into it. And less so with residential real estate. But that aspect of it really appealed to me. The aspect that I can make a timeline and know that if I follow this business plan, you know, that it will ultimately improve, right? Real estate has not really faltered. locally, sure, but real estate as a whole across the country hasn't really faltered, year over year in a very long time. So the control aspect is really what was big for me. And the idea that, I can directly control what's going to happen with this property or how much money it's going to make. And, there's market factors in there and how much you can get for rent and all of that. But ultimately, you're not going to go down in rent. Inflation is always going to be pushing it up. So that was big on why I really enjoy getting into real estate is the control aspect of it. And it's also pretty fun, right? It's fun to look at properties. It's fun to see and build business plans on what you could do with this property or that property, or how to make this work creatively in terms of purchasing the property, in terms of raising capital, selling the property, all of that. So it's almost like a puzzle game when you're looking at these properties and trying to figure out how to make it work. And especially on the syndication side of things is how to raise capital for this, how to make it amenable to investors and what works in terms of investor structure to get this deal done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I really like how you broke that down and want to follow it up with, it sounds like you've been in a number of different types of real estate investments, which makes sense. There are a lot of different ways to invest in real estate. And, this is kind of a general question, but what are some of the takeaways that you would have gathered from trying out, the different asset classes and ways of investing that you have so far?
Sure. A lot of lessons learned. I mean, like you said, there's a lot of different ways you can get into real estate investing. And, each person is going to have their own preference for what works, right? Depending on what their own situation is. So, for me, I definitely enjoyed the passive income aspect of it, essentially just investing capital and having it make a return for you. But there's also the control aspect that I enjoy as well, is being the active side of it. Is searching for deals and raising capital and ultimately closing on deals and running the deals. But for me, I enjoy the commercial real estate aspect of it a lot more than residential, just for that very reason, right? Residential, particularly when you're talking like flips and short-term rentals, tend to be a lot more based on comps or based on what's going on with the market. So it's almost like it's in your control, but it's almost not in your control. Because then you can have something like, a pandemic hit and, now no one's buying properties anymore, right? Now you're left with 5 or 10 different flips that you're trying to sell. But overall, commercial real estate as a whole, and specifically when I talk commercial real estate, I mean, multifamily, really for the most part, really wasn't affected too badly by what happened with the pandemic. People still need a place to live. People still, actually even more so, people needed a place to live. So you actually saw it. The pandemic actually did wonders for multifamily because now you have an increased demand and limited supply.
Yeah.
But in terms of lessons learned, I would say, hey, just dabble as much as you can if you're just getting started in real estate, because you never know what you're going to enjoy the most, right? Airbnbs were, they're fun, but they're also kind of a headache to deal with, right? There's a lot more management involved with it. And, depending on how fancy you want to make it, a lot more upfront capital that's involved with it. There's a lot more regulation that's coming down from local government. So, just because it's good today doesn't mean it's going to be good in a month from now or even legal in a month from now. So, there's pros and cons to every type of investing. It ultimately just depends on what the individual wants to do and what their ultimate mission or purpose is in regards to the real estate. If that's to be a real estate investor and make as much money as possible in a short amount of time, well, maybe flipping is a smart thing for you to do, especially if you have the time to do it or getting into Airbnbs. But I mean, if you're looking for long-term income or long-term, equity buildup, maybe, larger commercial real estate like apartment buildings or shopping centers or, industrial is a better way to go. If you have a full-time job, and you don't have time to go look at properties and buy properties, but you have money, maybe passive investing is a better option to go.
Yeah, for sure. That was a good overview. And just personally for yourself, where have your experiences led you in terms of what asset classes you want to focus on more, what you have focused on more, and what you're kind of looking to do in the future?
Sure. Sure. So great question. So I'm kind of give a quick background for the past year. So in 2020, basically, right after I got here, worked with some other general partners and took down 3 large multifamily deals, about 300 units total, a couple in Hampton Roads area and then one in Savannah. And so 2020 was a good year, in my opinion, to be in multifamily because there's a lot of people who were sitting on the sides trying to see how everything was going to shake out.
Yeah.
So ultimately, a lot less competition, although the lending side of things was a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. 2021 has proven to almost be the opposite of what we saw in 2020.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're involved with multifamily, but
Oh yeah.
It's, in my opinion, it's become overpriced and overcrowded. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's almost become like a red ocean and become really bloody with competition. Mm-hmm. And it's gone to the point where, you know, people are making and putting insane amounts of money down onto these deals and making insane terms that it just, it makes it untenable to compete against a lot of investors, particularly large institutional investors that are looking to place a lot of capital. Mm-hmm. And even new investors, new beginner investors. So, you know, this, I think the same thing that you're seeing with single family homes, with how much competition there is to buy, is the same thing with multifamily. And, you know, you can look at 100 deals across a number of different markets and still not find a deal that actually pencils out and makes sense for that very reason. Mm-hmm. So I think multifamily is an amazing opportunity. You know, like I said, people need a place to live. People are always going to need a place to live. And historically, it's done very well. But in my opinion, there's a lot of cutting corners on underwriting. There's a lot of people who are structuring fees up front in terms of general partners that just doesn't make sense for passive investors to get involved in, and just taking insane risks in terms of E&D and going hard and all that. In my mind, it's like I said, it's become a red ocean of competition, and just it's super overpriced. So I kind of realized that for me, my time is very limited here, the amount of energy I have. I maybe have 2 or 3 hours a day being awake at the same time as everyone else back in the States to be able to talk with investors and look at deals and talk with brokers and evaluate what makes sense. So it's very limited for me to be able to work and the time that is needed to take down a lot of these deals. I mean, you're talking almost hours that you need to be able to respond back to brokers and get terms and all this set up. So it's not the best use of my time and energy right now. So I needed to find a better opportunity or a better asset class. And I met a good friend of mine now, a good mentor. His name's Gene, who had been involved with shopping centers and retail for the longest time. And, you know, retail gets a pretty bad rep, but it's kind of earned. I mean, when you think of retail, you think of shopping malls and you think of, you know, people no longer going to shopping malls and that e-commerce is taking over, that Amazon's going to be the future and all that, which is pretty true. And you've seen a pretty hard impact with e-commerce growing up, especially over the past year and with the pandemic. You know, people just weren't going out and buying things anymore and buying clothes and stuff. But within this niche of retail as a whole, you know, large shopping centers, power shopping centers, all that, you have this niche that kind of become a veritable gold mine, in my opinion, that's community shopping centers. And these shopping centers are the ones who are located in your neighborhoods. They're located in, you know, maybe 5 minutes away from you, that have, you know, grocery stores, and they have hair salons, and they have, you know, more necessity-based types of tenants, coffee shops, right? Things that people are going to go to even during a pandemic, right? Liquor stores, for example, right? So these community shopping centers actually thrived and did really well during the pandemic because people still went to them even during the pandemic. People still need to go get, you know, medical stuff done. People still want to go to the gym. People still want to, you know, need auto parts. They still need, you know, urgent care. They still need to go get their hair cut. They still want to go get, you know, their nails done. So outside of retail itself, it's a very good model because it's sitting within this retail category where a lot of people are very hesitant to invest in it, much less look at it. They don't really know how to look at it because you're dealing with leases that are very different than multifamily and residential as a whole. Right. You're dealing with leases with business tenants that, you know, you're having increases in annual increases in rent. You're having much longer leases. You're having a lot more stipulations in there. And the lease negotiation can be pretty complicated, particularly if you're getting in, you know, much larger national or international tenants. So it's opportunity that is much less competition. If multifamily has become a red ocean, it's the blue ocean of investing, in my opinion. There's much less competition. You're seeing cap rates that are much more tenable to being able to buy them and make money off of them. You're able to be a lot more creative with how these deals go down. It's more so, hey, you have an 80% vacancy. You need to fill the 20% in multifamily. It's okay, I have, you know, 80% vacancy. I have this much square foot. You know, there's a million different ways that we can fill that space, you know, a million different types of tenants. We can split up this space. You know, we have a large amount of parking. We can put an extra pad there. I mean, there's a lot of different creative ways that you can take down these centers and build a business plan that ultimately is going to make a lot of money off of this. So that's what we're getting into now is the community shopping center side of thing, really to combat the overcrowdedness that is multifamily.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense, especially also given, you know, your time constraints being over in Japan. And I have heard someone else as in the way of like that they still believe in retail at Main and Main, which is kind of what you're talking about. You know, these places that are close that people still are going to be going to, and there's still a way to make those into valuable spaces for the community that people want to go to physically and spend money at. So would you be able to, you know, if possible, walk us through maybe an example of one community shopping center that you've looked at and what your plan is and if it's been implemented or not? Really curious to hear.
Sure. So we do have a property to contract right now in the Hampton Roads area. It's in Chesapeake, if you want to know specifically. So that's a 35,000 square foot place, you know, buying it for a few million dollars. And the property itself is about 97% occupying. There's one space that like 1,000 square foot space that needs to get filled, which it should be pretty easy. But the other thing is that we're looking at the leases and when they all expire and realize that one of the tenants' lease expires in about 5 months from now. And it's a pretty large space. It's about an 8,000 square foot space. And it's true retail. It's a music instrument place. So it's not like people are going there and you know, it's not like a gym or it's not a coffee shop where people are going and they're getting some sort of, you know, experience, right? That place was shut down essentially during COVID. Like people weren't really going there. And so the opportunity presented itself to take that 8,000 square foot place and do a number of different things with it. It originally was a lot much smaller space and it just essentially got cut up or it essentially got moved into one big, large 8,000 square foot place. So we can split into four different 2,000 square foot places. We can split it into two 4,000 square foot places and place, you know, a couple tenants in there. Really what it comes down to is can you build a business plan with your leasing broker that makes sense for who is looking for space there, right? So a lot of it comes down to timing and who you know that can fill that space.
Yeah.
And, you know, for us, it's also the fact that that tenant is, you know, paying half of the rent that the rest of the tenants are paying in terms of price per square foot, or I guess rent per square foot for that place. So, you know, we're also looking at the fact that that alone, if we just put in a tenant that's at market rent with everyone else right now, is going to double the income from that space. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the market rent in that area is actually about $3 or $4 higher than what the current park, you know, market rates are for that area. So we're looking at that. We're also looking at the fact that there's a pretty large parking space that's not really being used. So we could build an extra pad there and put more tenants there, you know, more smaller space tenants. So, you know, 3,000-4,000 square foot total. There's thoughts about putting in.
And what kind of tenants do you have in mind for, like, I mean, I know there's like a probably more than you can name right now, but what are some examples of smaller tenants that you might look for?
So it really just depends on how, what the space looks like and what it's actually, you know, split out to be and what type of amenities, I guess, are you know, put into there. Because it may not make sense to put in, you know, like a Subway if there's already, you know, three other sub spots in there. Might not make sense to put a pizza place in there. And you also have to look at the fact that these contracts may even prohibit, you know, other competitors that have, you know, are a similar, mm-hmm. you know, type of restaurant or a similar, you know, business structure. So overall, I mean, you're looking at, you know, pizza places for smaller spaces like that. You're looking at, you know, nail salons can be pretty small. It really just depends on what the space specifically has available to it. But that's really where it comes down to finding the right leasing broker and who, what contacts they have available that are looking for a space mm-hmm. that size. Really outside of the retail aspect of it, you're just saying, hey, you know, we have 1,000 foot space or, you know, 1,100 foot space. We have 10 tenants who could specifically fill that space. What are the things we're looking at? Well, what price per or rent per square foot can we actually get for that space? What makes the most sense in terms of the tenant improvements that we're going to need to make to make that space actually leasable, if you will, right? For example, like if you're doing a cold soak creamery, well, there's obviously a lot of tenant improvements you need to go into that to put, you know, the big cold storage refrigeration in there versus a nail salon or versus the haircut place where you may not need really any of that, right? You may just need an open space and they'll fill in the rest of their chairs. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of things you're looking at when you're looking at these, how to fill these different spaces is, you know, what does it cost to me as the landlord to be able to put someone in there? Are there any other contract issues with the competing competitor, with competing tenants within that area, or even, you know, within outside of the specific shopping center, if there's any restrictions on who can actually go there? For example, like Starbucks has a pretty stiff contract for who can actually be in the shopping center that it's a part of.
Okay.
Right. Like they can't obviously have other coffee shops, you know, nearby. They actually don't allow gyms nearby there. So you really have to kind of, it's like a puzzle trying to figure out who can you put here that's not going to compete with other people within the shopping center or violate contracts there. And does it make sense to put that type of tenant in there, given, you know, what the future looks like, right?
Okay. Why do you think Starbucks doesn't want gyms nearby? I can't quite figure that out.
I haven't been able to figure that out myself. I think it's mainly because of the type of people that get drawn to that area and what having a gym there actually, I guess, does for them. I haven't completely figured that one out. You know, it's one of those things where they just have it in there because they probably have past experience with it. But I mean, you tend to get those kind of weird stipulations when you have much larger tenants, like national or international brand tenants. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole nother can of worms when you're trying to negotiate with a larger tenant like that. Because, you know, ultimately they have a lot more, I guess, negotiation power because they have a lot more money to throw around and a lot more options ultimately available to look at, to, you know, be able to lease their spots out.
Yeah, for sure. Interesting. And so in terms of this asset class, do you feel like it's easy to sleep at night? Like, is there any sort of worry or, and how have you managed that if so?
Sure. It's a good question. You know, with multifamily, actually with all three of the properties that we bought in the last year, we've had a fire there.
Oh my God.
That's taken down, you know, at least a unit or two. And in one case, it's took down a whole building, 12 units. And so, we have insurance for it and that's great. But ultimately, like, you know, that whole insurance process takes a long time, right? And those units are going to be down. And now you have tenants that can't have a place to live and all that. So it's a huge mess. And it's ultimately your responsibility as a landlord to be able to, you know, fix that and make it rentable again, right? The tenants are just going to move on and find another place to live. But when you're dealing with a shopping center like that, if a fire happens in a particular unit, like that's on the tenant to have it fixed and make the space ready to rent again, right?
Yeah.
So essentially you're just leasing a space to them and you're controlling everything outside of that. So the facade, the parking lot, you know, the outside lighting, the air conditioning units, HVAC, trash, stuff like that. And so it's kind of the best case scenario because you're dealing with a triple net lease. So the tenant is essentially paying for everything in regards to the property itself and leasing out that space. You know, they're paying common area maintenance costs. So they're taking essentially all the fees that you're paying for in terms of like contracts, like service contracts for like pest control and snow removal and stuff like that, trash removal. That's all, a piece of that is all being shared among the tenants there. So you're actually having, you know, if you get to fulfill your full business plan, you have 100% recoverables, right? So really all of your expenses are being completely covered by the rent that's coming in from these tenants. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but they're paying for insurance, they're paying for taxes, real estate taxes, all of that. So I think, in my opinion, you sleep a lot better dealing with business tenants, especially businesses that have been there a lot longer, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you're dealing with leases and multifamily, you're dealing with, you know, maybe one or two tenants and you do a background check and you do a credit check and all of that, and you can see if they've had an eviction, right? But you never know what's going to happen with COVID if they lose their job or, you know, something happens with their family. I've had both of those things happen where someone had a lease with us for 3 months and then something happened with their family and they like ghosted us essentially.
Yeah.
And had to move after 3 months lease. Right. So things happen like that when you're dealing with, you know, residential tenants. But with, you know, commercial tenants, hey, someone doesn't pay, you know, you're locking up the front door to their business, right? You're having tenants that have proven, you know, have proven business model, especially if you're dealing with much larger tenants. This shopping center, for example, half of the tenants have been in there for 10 or more years. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty safe bet that, you know, those tenants are going to continue to do well, even through COVID, even through the, you know, the end of 2008, 2009, these tenants were still kind of pushing through all of that. So it's really, you know, you're doing the same kind of calculus when you're putting in residential tenants into multifamily. In my opinion, you're having a much safer bet when you're dealing with business tenants that this is their business, and especially mom and pop shops, like this is their life, right? So they're going to do everything they can to try to make the rent, to try to get leases, to try to get sales coming in, right? And there's a lot more options ultimately, I think, and a lot quicker options for business to be able to get, you know, capital to be able to survive. Like in the case of COVID, you know, residential tenants, gosh, you know, it was only like, there was like $47 billion, I think, in rental assistance that like ultimately never made it to renters across the country, right? I mean, we're still dealing with some of our multifamily properties. We're still dealing with tenants who have back pay, back rent due from last year. Mm-hmm. But with, you know, with commercial tenants, that PPP program mm-hmm. was amazing. Like I was able to get money for my business, you know, pretty quickly within like a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for, you know, a lot of other business tenants. So, you know, in my opinion, the risk is a lot less because you're, for a lot of different reasons, but I think the biggest one is you're dealing with commercial tenants yeah. who have a lot more options to be able to make money and provide for their rent mm-hmm. in the long term.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a lot longer terms in terms of leases themselves. I mean, you're dealing with 5, 10, 20, 25, 30 year leases, especially, you know, with some of these larger national tenants. Like, you know, we were looking at a property that had a Jiffy Lube in it and their lease was 30 years. A 30-year lease. And, you know, they were thriving through that whole time.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, overall, you know, it's much easier management and maintenance because you're not really dealing with a lot of that, right? These tenants are a lot easier to deal with. I mean, you can audit them, their financials anytime. And like I said, you know, if you run into an eviction situation, they're not paying, like you have a lot more flexibility to be able to take that property back than having to go through the whole eviction process with
yeah.
tenants. So do I sleep better at night because of it? Yeah, I think so. Than dealing with multifamily.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really important perspective and some of it I've heard before, but it's just helpful to hear your take on it. And retail does make a lot of people nervous, but there's ways to control for it. Just like in any real estate investment, you know, you're not just going to invest in any multifamily deal. It has to be the right deal. And the same is true in retail. And for all the reasons that you just mentioned, it can be potentially even better in a lot of regards. So thanks so much for going into, you know, a lot of great detail on that. And, you know, just for the listeners who maybe have some sort of limiting beliefs around long distance investing, what would you say to those folks? I mean, you're doing this from Japan. How do you make it work? And what advice would you give?
Sure. So I would say that you need to find the right partners to be able to take down these types of deals. And whether that's finding deals, being boots on the ground, raising capital, talking with brokers, whatever it is. Unless you're like working nights and you're up at the same time as everyone else back in the States, like it's very difficult to manage those types of relationships. And obviously you can't just go leave and go see, you know, the property at any time, like if you want to, right? Especially if you're overseas. So I think that's the biggest thing is making sure that you find the right partners and you align with those partners who are back in the States. And also realize what you can and can't do from here. So if, you know, obviously you can't it's difficult to asset manage a property from overseas because you, like I said, for the very reason that you're overseas and you can't go visit the property or talk with people. But there are things you could do. You could do marketing. You could do capital raising. You could do searching for properties to some extent. You could do underwriting. Right. I mean, there's a lot of different things that you can do overseas that I think a lot of people have limiting beliefs about ultimately. But don't get me wrong. It is difficult to invest from over here. But if you find the right partners that align with you in terms of your principles and values and the skills that they bring, I think that's ultimately what makes a business work from over here, specifically in real estate when investing overseas.
And so just to expand on that, like, well, first of all, I think it does make sense that, you know, nothing that's worth doing is easy usually. So what is it from long distance that you're able to add to the team of people who are in the US?
Sure. So, I mean, like I said, I've had experience with multifamily in the past and raising capital overall. So that was a big thing with my ability to raise capital, but also the experience that we've had with, you know, looking at different leases, the ability to evaluate in a particular area, you know, what's going to happen when we sell or when we buy this property in terms of real estate taxes. We can look at what the expenses look like overall in terms of utilities. So I have a lot of that experience with terms of underwriting and the amount of time I have outside, you know, obviously the same amount of time that everyone's awake. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of different things I'm doing in terms of these partnerships that, you know, are worthwhile overall outside of actually being able to asset manage or talking with brokers or finding deals. Because that seems to be the sexy part of it, right? Like people want it to be the asset manager. People want to go be the acquisitions guy and go find these deals and walk the deals and take the pictures. And, you know, it looks cool, right? At the end of the day, like you still need someone who can get the lending contacts, you know, made up, still, you know, make the LLCs to raise capital, do all these extra background things that aren't as sexy, in my opinion.
For sure. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And are you guys finding deals off market, or how are you sourcing deals?
So right now, a lot of our deals have been coming through brokers. We're kind of getting the machine ramped up to have a lot more off deals coming through, but majority of our deals have been coming through brokers. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Anthony, for giving us so much insight into real estate investing in general, as well as this asset class of investing in retail, because it's really important. And especially as the multifamily space gets, you know, more and more heated, which, you know, it very much is doing so in 2021. So thanks again for coming on the show. Please share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and anything else you want to share.
Sure. Absolutely. So you can if you want to contact me, you can reach me at Facebook, on LinkedIn. You can shoot me an email at anthony@guidepostinvestmentgroup.com. You can also check out our website, Guidepost Investment Group. We have a lot more about who we are, the assets we've invested in, and more details on why we think community shopping centers are the best option for you. You can also check out free deal package and see what our deals look like and what the structure looks like and, you know, overall business plan. And if you want to chat more, happy to reach out and chat with you.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. I hope you all take some time and check out Anthony and his firm and what they're up to, because it's pretty interesting and important stuff. Thanks again, Anthony, for coming on and dropping so much knowledge. Really appreciate it. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks, CJ.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, luxe-cap.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.